Mexico is Arizona's biggest trading partner, but 5 years ago today, SB 1070 put that relationship to the test. State officials have been working to pass that test ever since.
There's been a lot of emphasis on how we, bridge the opportunity that exists for U.S. and Mexico and really play to the strengths of the NAFTA region.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, Trading with Our Neighbors. Also, Sheriff Joe Arpaio is back on the stand in his contempt of court hearing. We'll get an update.
How Arizona schools are changing the school year.
And repurposing produce and helping low-income residents.
Vegetables are a very nutritious product, but it is an expensive commodity.
Plus, keeping up appearances after biking to work and the Valley's shifting live music scene.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Quick check of traffic and a disabled vehicle on I-10 eastbound at 27th Avenue. Be aware of that. In the Valley forecast for today, partly sunny with a very small chance for some rain. We are looking for a high of 82 degrees, partly cloudy, 30% chance of showers tonight, overnight lows near 60. It's partly sunny out right now, 80 degrees at KJZZ.
Governor Doug Ducey has ordered the Department of Child Safety to allow both married same-sex parents to legally adopt a child in state care. This overrides legal advice from the Attorney General's office. But as KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports, the issue goes back to October, when same-sex marriage became legal in Arizona.
DCS began allowing both parents to be listed on adoption certificates. Then the Attorney General's office advised the agency that wasn't legal, so DCS halted the practice. DCS says that didn't stop same-sex couples from adopting. It meant only one parent could be on the license. Adoption attorney Greg Woodnick says the state has separate laws for adoption and marriage.
Title VIII language refers to a husband and wife may jointly adopt children. It's antiquated because it's not gender neutral. And just because the language of Title VIII hasn't caught up to the ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals does not mean that it should be ignored.
The Maricopa County Attorney's Office has refused to offer same-sex couples the free legal adoption help it offers straight couples until the U.S. Supreme Court rules on same-sex marriage. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Supreme Court is refusing to exclude challenged Scottsdale Crime Lab blood alcohol test results, saying jurors should consider whether alleged flaws in the testing should make the results unreliable. The court ruled today after a lower court split on whether test results could be used as evidence against 11 DUI defendants.
Today is the third of a scheduled four-day civil contempt hearing for Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio before Federal Judge Murray Snow. The sheriff took the stand yesterday afternoon and continued to face questions this morning. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block has covered the entire hearing and joins us from downtown Phoenix. Now, Jude, there was an interesting development late in sheriff's testimony this morning related to Judge Snow directly. Can you give us some background?
Judge Murray Snow had an opportunity to ask Arpaio questions directly while he was on the stand. And one of the things that he asked about is a Phoenix New Times article written by Steve Lemons, which includes rumors that the sheriff's office had at some point investigated Snow in some way. And the judge asked the sheriff directly, have you at any point investigated me or my family members? And what came out from that is that, in fact, the sheriff's office had at some point received some kind of tip from an email that Judge Snow's wife was overheard at a restaurant saying that Judge Snow intended to ensure that the sheriff would not be reelected. And at that point, it sounds like the sheriff's office lawyers, this might have been Tim Casey, it was a little unclear, hired a private investigator to try to corroborate whether that was true. And then it sounds like there was also a second investigation. This one has to do with a confidential informant who suggested to the sheriff's office a theory that there was some kind of conspiracy, an alleged conspiracy involving the Department of Justice, intercepting email and telephone communications of judges, including Snow, as well as the sheriff and their attorneys, and that he acknowledged that investigation was still ongoing. So this is really new information. I still haven't wrapped my head around it even. Everyone out here is buzzing, just trying to figure out what just went on. So very unexpected turn this morning.
Was there surprise in the courtroom that the judge even directed these questions at the sheriff? Was there a great surprise at just the content of it more than that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there was a lot of surprise in the courtroom when this happened. This was certainly for those of us watching, did not see this happening. Before that, you know, it was maybe a lot more what we'd expect to happen. The plaintiff's attorneys had tried to show the sheriff video clips of himself at different points talking about his immigration enforcement with a lot of bravado, talking about he would continue to enforce immigration laws, and playing clips about that when, in fact, you know, the sheriff's office was under a court order to not be detaining immigrants solely for violating federal immigration law for being in the country unlawfully. And what came out is that they had, in fact, for 18 months continued turning over immigrants that couldn't be arrested on state crimes over to ICE. And at one point, the sheriff did actually turn to the judge and apologize and say that it was his violations of the order were not intentional, that he did not mean to, that he's been a public servant for 55 years, and that this was a painful experience for him to be going through.
Well, overall, that's interesting as well. So could you characterize what the sheriff's tone has been during the testimony? Has it been similar to what you're saying there when he apologizes? Has he been more low-key than we expect?
Well, I mean, before he took the stand, you know, the sheriff in the hallway was sort of the same old sheriff that we know, sort of joking with attorneys, and he seemed very much himself. But on the stand, he takes a much quieter demeanor. His voice is sort of hoarse and raspy, and he doesn't speak very loud. And there's a big contrast when they've been playing clips of video clips of him, you know, talking to the media in a sort of a booming, assertive voice. There's really a big contrast there.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block from downtown Phoenix. Jude, thank you as always.
Thank you, Steve.
One of the world's richest men was in Phoenix yesterday to talk about Arizona's relationship with Mexico. Governor Doug Ducey introduced Carlos Slim Helú.
Arizona is sending a strong and positive message that we value Mexico and that we are open for business.
According to the Greater Phoenix Economic Council, there's an average of $13 to $14 billion worth of exchange between Arizona and Mexico each year. But 5 years ago today, that relationship took a bit of a hit when then-Governor Jan Brewer signed SB 1070 into law. For more on how that affected trade and what's changed since then, we turn to Chris Camacho, GPAC's president and CEO.
Well, obviously, Arizona and Mexico are significant trading partners, and you know, when we have these kind of important ties to the economy, any type of dialogue that doesn't coincide with the intent of both nations to import and export product, ultimately, you know, it leads to a decline in interaction and a decline in visitations, and ultimately money's flowing across the border both ways. And so since that time, I think under the leadership of Governor Ducey and the city of Phoenix under Mayor Stanton, there's been a lot of emphasis on how we, you know, bridge the opportunity that exists for U.S. and Mexico, and really play to the strengths of the NAFTA region, being that we are the centerpiece of the NAFTA region, and the importance of the growing Hispanic and immigrant population in Arizona is going to yield benefits for the future economy.
Do you think that the improvement of relations over the last 5 years has been a gradual thing over that time, or was there one thing or two things that you can point to and say that really helped improve things?
Well, I would certainly say in more recent times, the commitment from the state and the city to place a trade office in Mexico City has really elevated the engagement in both markets. And the commitment from, again, Governor Ducey's administration and City of Phoenix and others, and the business community alike, taking participant trips to Mexico and then welcoming you know, a number of the Mexican delegations that in the last 24 months have visited Arizona. And I think it's dramatically changed the way that this partnership has worked, you know, really in the last decade. And I think we're now on track to take advantage, coming off of Carlos Slim's visit yesterday with Ray Shea at the Phoenix Business Journal. Yeah, I think it's great that we continue to foster that relationship and really find ways, as you look at the Mexican middle-class market and its growth, the opportunity for Arizona's economy to grow is how we support our small medium-sized enterprises as they export products and services to Mexico.
In your mind, do you think that going forward, Mexico will continue to be Arizona's number one trading partner?
Absolutely, and I think if you know, study what's happening in the Mexican economy with the rise of the middle class and the industrialization that's occurring, along with a lot of the nearshoring movement to Mexico in the manufacturing sector. You know, Mexico is going to quickly rise to become a top market globally in GDP, and that's going to happen over the next 20 years. And so that, as the market evolves, it's only going to play a much more important role to Arizona, certainly, and that's notwithstanding the fact that our population base is quickly becoming a minority majority as well. And so the cultural linkages that tie these two markets together are very relevant and critical to Arizona's future success.
As Mexico rises sort of in the global economy, does that mean that Arizona will face more competition from other states or other countries that are also looking to trade with Mexico that maybe aren't doing so right now?
There is absolutely no question that as the Mexican economy evolves, there will be other states that wish to participate more so in alignment with Mexico. With that said, we're in a fortuitous position, along with California, New Mexico, and Texas being a neighboring border state. You have, you know, direct proximal distant connectivity that forces you to become aligned. So I think we have a distinct advantage, and at the same time, you know, we must continue to enable that relationship and invest in that relationship as these other states along the border are doing so.
Chris Camacho is president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. Chris, thanks.
Thank you very much for having me today.
And we'll have more on trade coming up on the show as Congress takes up a proposed Trans-Pacific trade deal in Washington, D.C. That and much, much more still to come on the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. These clouds will stick around through tonight. In fact, we have a 30% chance for some rain with overnight lows around 60. Expect partly sunny skies tomorrow with a slight chance for rain as well. And a high temperature well below normal at 80 degrees. Currently, relative humidity is at 16%. And we're at 80 at KJZZ. In Valley traffic, a couple of accidents to watch out for, both on I-10 eastbound. One is at 27th Avenue, the other 75th Avenue, and there's a short stretch of heavy slowing on the 51 southbound as you approach Glendale.
KJZZ is supported by Holland America Line, offering 7 and 14-day Alaska cruises sailing round-trip from Seattle, departing May through September. Information is available through a travel professional or at hollandamerica.com.
It's the show. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Steve Goldstein. It's a very rare moment indeed when Republicans agree with President Barack Obama. But when it comes to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a massive trade deal with nearly a dozen countries around the Pacific Ocean, representing about 40% of the world economy, Republicans are not just behind the White House, but they're hoping to give the president more authority to fast-track the deal.
If passed, it would be the largest trade deal since NAFTA went into effect. The House Ways and Means Committee enters the debate today to consider giving the president that special authority to finish negotiating a trade accord with the Pacific Rim nations.
The process is moving in the Senate, too. The Senate Finance Committee approved its own version late last night, but only after liberal Democrats forced hours of delay.
Now, this deal has sharply divided the president from many in his own party. Here's Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking to CBS This Morning earlier this month.
I have real concerns about something that basically would permit multinational companies to sue other countries when they try to put regulations in place to protect their own workers, to protect their own citizens. I think this is a really dangerous provision in a trade deal.
And does that
I'd
put
like
you on the opposite side from the president?
It certainly does.
It certainly does.
Well, that prompted the president to go on MSNBC this week to defend the deal.
I love Elizabeth. We're allies on a whole host of issues, but she's wrong on this.
And the president went on.
I would not be doing this trade deal if I did not think it was good for the middle class. And when you hear folks make a lot of suggestions about how bad this trade deal is, when you dig into the facts, they are wrong.
Well, the opposition isn't just Elizabeth Warren. It includes a majority of House Democrats. It includes Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid himself. And so the president and Republicans are now agreeing to give the public more time to review the now secret deal once it's finalized, but that is likely to be the next president's problem. Well, we have two voices now, one for and one against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. First, Lori Wallach. She's director of Global Trade Watch. It's a division of Public Citizen. Lori is critical of this deal. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you very much.
So Congress this week is dealing with the fast track portion of this whole deal, giving the president more authority to push through the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Do you think there's a chance Democrats could kill it?
The way it looks right now is the vote that's up is a procedure. It's not the agreement. It's a very archaic, undemocratic procedure that actually Nixon cooked up, rarely been used. It's called fast track. And it would basically take away all of Congress's normal overview and procedural safeguards about a vote. And that vote right now, there is almost no Democratic support in Congress. And there are a lot of Republican rank and file members who are opposed. So the way the politics lines up, bizarrely, is it's the president and the Republican leadership in Congress, plus the hugest pack of corporations, all the interests that tried to wipe him out as a president, didn't want him reelected. And that would be the pharmaceutical companies and the oil and gas companies and the big multinational producers that are chronic job offshores and the big retailers like Walmart and Kmart. And then the other side is the entire Democratic base. Because the TPP would not only make it easier to offshore our jobs and undermine our wages by throwing us in competition with Vietnam, but also, as Senator Warren has pointed out, would roll back financial regulation, would make us import food that doesn't meet our safety standards, would roll back some of the energy conservation and climate policies this president struggled to put into place. You have the broadest coalition of the entire Democratic base, from consumer and environmental groups, to the faith and family farm groups, to the internet freedom groups, to the unions, to small business organizations, the opposition, and almost every member, Democratic member of Congress is stunning.
Well, Lori, a lot of the discomfort in that coalition that you just mentioned goes back to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, 1993, 1994. What went wrong with NAFTA in the perception of that coalition that you're talking about that's making them so very opposed to the deal today?
Well, TPP is actually based, the text is based on the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, which President Obama did in 2012. And that agreement, the Korea Agreement, was based on NAFTA in 1993. The crux of what's wrong with NAFTA is that it has, over its 21 years, resulted in an enormous loss of not just U.S. manufacturing jobs, but it has also resulted in losses of service sector jobs, downward pressure on wages. But it's not just NAFTA, that agreement. That agreement heralded in a model of trade agreements. And at the heart of those agreements is the most job-losing provision of the TPP. It's a provision that incentivizes job offshoring by providing special rights and privileges to foreign investors if they relocate the jobs. Now, all the TPP has been negotiated in extreme secrecy, but luckily WikiLeaks leaked that chapter of TPP. It's called the investment chapter. The result from NAFTA was that literally 40,000 companies up and relocated.
Well, Lori Wallach, what's wrong with the principle of these trade deals, which basically say it's a global economy where countries have to interact in a new way? And yes, you lose certain kinds of jobs in a free trade deal. You mentioned a lot of them, a lot of manufacturing jobs for sure. But when you do it, you reorient your economy in a more accessible way that gives you access to emerging markets in places like Asia, Europe, places like that.
So trade is good, and we have to figure out how to expand our exports and be successful in the globalized economy, no doubt. The problem with TPP and the question with every trade agreement is trade, yes, but under what rules? Who writes them and who are they set to benefit? This has become a corporate Trojan horse to implement a lot of policies that wouldn't and in fact haven't passed in Congress. This is the most threatening attack on middle class jobs and wages, but also many of the most important consumer and environmental protections on which all of our families rely.
Lori Wallach is director of Global Trade Watch. It's a division of Public Citizen. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to another view. Susan Schwab is former U.S. Trade Representative under President George W. Bush. She's currently a professor at the University of Maryland, and she supports this deal. Susan Schwab, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Is the Trans-Pacific Partnership a Trojan horse, as Lori Wallach said, one that benefits pharmaceutical companies, limits internet freedom, undermines environmental regulations and wages?
No, it appears to be a very fine agreement, very strong, very robust, and will, like our previous free trade agreements with 20 other countries, go a long way in increasing U.S. exports, increasing benefits to U.S. consumers, small, medium size, as well as large exporters, farmers, manufacturers, workers, service providers, a whole variety of U.S. Interests.
Susan Schwab, what about parts of this deal apparently that give multinational corporations the power to challenge domestic environmental and labor laws, that basically let the companies who have a stake in the trade to try to undermine environmental regulations, wage regulations, workplace safety regulations?
Well, I think you ought to take a look at the existing trade agreements, starting with the free trade agreement that was negotiated with Peru, Colombia, South Korea, Panama. The last four, for example, have enforceable labor and environmental standards. These are provisions that were demanded by labor and environmental groups in the United States for 10, 15 years. And then lo and behold, once they were included in trade agreements as enforceable standards, those groups in the United States that had said, oh, but for the lack of these provisions, we would support trade agreements, now they've come up with other reasons for opposing these trade agreements.
Well, of course, Susan Schwab, the president is on your side on this one, but a big part of his political base isn't, and they're getting more and more vocal. The White House has acknowledged to reporters and a lot of other people that NAFTA hasn't lived up to the hype, in the White House's words, and that the president is really making a special new effort for enforceable environmental regulations, workplace safety, workers' protections in this deal. Your assessment of the geopolitical balance of power right now, does the president have new leverage, more leverage than maybe we had or wanted during NAFTA, for the president to assuage the concerns of so many people on his left?
Well, I would have liked to have seen the president move earlier on trade promotion authority and a trade agenda. I think you find a lot of Republicans who would have liked to see that. You would have found a lot of Democrats who would like to see that. I mean, trade is, in fact, bipartisan. I think perhaps you exaggerate to an extent the number of Democrats who oppose trade. Unfortunately, you've got this very strong, as you note, and vocal opposition from a wing of the Democratic Party. It is controlled by big labor. If you look at who is going to benefit, it's American workers who are going to benefit. It's American farmers. It's ranchers. You do not win in trade by ignoring the 95% of consumers, global consumers, who are sitting outside our borders.
Susan Schwab, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Susan Schwab is former U.S. Trade Representative under President George W. Bush.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
American students generally spend about 180 days in school each school year, but districts around the country, including those in Arizona, have been playing with the calendar a bit to change how those 180 days are spread out. The National Center on Time and Learning studies this kind of thing. It issues a report every other year on the subject. The most recent came out this week. Jennifer Davis is the group's co-founder and president.
We were looking at whether there really has been a breakout of the traditional American school calendar that's been in place for 150 years based on the agrarian economy. And the great news is that there's really starting to be a trend around districts and certainly charter schools that are innovating around school time for learning.
Do you find that they are adding more days to the year? Are they sort of playing around with when students are in session and keeping the same number of days?
Yes. The school year has stayed roughly the same, 180 days across the year, but the school day and the schedule of the school day has significantly expanded and actually doubled. The number of schools have doubled in the last 2 years with regard to those that have deliberately expanded the school day to enable more learning and enrichment time for students and more collaboration and development time for teachers.
To what do you attribute that?
Well, there's really a recognition among policy leaders and educators that the agrarian schedule for American schools no longer meet the needs of today's students. I mean, we have a much higher set of expectations, we have a very economically competitive world, and we're not preparing our students for the future. And to do that, we really need to think more creatively around time and learning and how much time students, particularly those living in poverty, have in school.
When you look at this issue 2 years from now, do you have a sense of what you might find?
I think we're going to see another doubling of the number of schools with more time for learning because this achievement gap challenge isn't going away, and there's more and more concern, particularly if you think about students that where English is not their first language. They need more time for learning and support around literacy. And so I think the trend is going to continue. I also think we'll see more and more state laws that are really encouraging innovation around this area. You're also going to see innovation around time and learning through the use of technology. You're already seeing a lot of that in Arizona and other states. So I think we're going to continue to see some creative change to the American school calendar, which I think is a really positive thing.
Jennifer Davis is co-founder and president of the National Center on Time and Learning. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mark.
In Arizona, most schools stick to that 180-day school year. There is a law allowing them to add 20 days to their calendars, but it only provides a 5% funding increase to do it. For more on this, we turn to Tracy Benson. She's Associate Executive Director of the Arizona School Boards Association.
There are very few school districts in Arizona that have calendars that are longer than 180 days. About 8 school districts and charter schools operate for an additional 20 days and making it a 200-day calendar.
Why do you think it is that not many have taken advantage of this state law that allows them to add days?
I think it boils down to a funding issue. Basically, districts are trying to maximize the instructional opportunities during that 180 days that they're funded for. And as you know, funding has been shrinking for public schools, so it's become more difficult to maintain the quality programs just in 180 days, let alone stretch it out to 200.
Do districts feel that 180 days is a good amount of time to have students in the classroom and the number of hours, the amount of time that students are in the classroom is a good amount?
You know, I think it's a fairly well accepted number, but we see districts in Arizona sort of playing around with how they're scheduling out those 180 days. The extended school year or the year-round school year where they're putting blocks of time, breaks within the school year to give students not that long summer time where they may have a summer slump, they call it, in terms of their academic achievement. But it also builds time into the school year for kids who need intervention and not saving all that up to do over the summertime, but maybe in a few key periods throughout the year.
What are some of the kinds of extracurriculars or sort of enrichment programs that districts have tried to offer to their students as a way to sort of extend the school day, but not maybe in a traditional classroom setting?
We've got some really excellent after-school programming that are school site-based around the state of Arizona. And they are bringing all kinds of things in. They're bringing tutoring in. They're bringing STEM hands-on activities. They're doing learning activities on computers. And it's really reinforcing the school day lessons through these enriching learning opportunities.
Do you expect any appreciable change in the state law relating to school calendars, school years, funding for districts that decide to do that in the coming years?
You know, it's a discussion that I think is going to continue to be on the table because there are districts around the state who definitely do want to increase the amount of instructional time that students are getting. It's, I think, until that gets passed, it's going to be perpetual discussion, and hopefully we'll get a little bit closer to that. But you have to realize, you know, we've got tough budget times right now, and even priorities like just providing funding for full-day kindergarten haven't been realized yet in Arizona. So the 200-day school year might be a little bit farther off.
Tracy Benson is Associate Executive Director of the Arizona School Boards Association. Tracy, thanks.
Thanks, Mark. It was a pleasure.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
You know his name.
You know his name.
It's Mr. Burns.
We host monthly Simpsons Trivia Night.
Otto, Itchy and Scratchy, Homer, Mr. Burns, they're all here.
Well, we're kind of obsessed with it. We'll go hours without saying an original thought. This is all Simpsons quotes.
Everybody come up with a team name.
Tonight we are Don't Do What Donnie Don't Does, which should be really fun for the host to try to say.
The first time we did it, we actually made the questions way too hard, and the scores were like 12 out of 60.
It was a rutabaga.
Ah. Number six, Krusty hits on what famous musician when he finds himself in Super Bowl jail? Dolly Parton.
It's really just about talking about and goofing about our favorite show.
It's a laugh.
That was JRC and Diana Welsh hosting Simpsons Trivia Night and Teresa Newkirk playing along at Bragg's Factory Diner. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Springfield, Springfield, or rather Phoenix, Phoenix,
don't.
Send us a note, the show at KJZZ.org.
Still to come, biking to work means sharing the road with morning traffic, and a little Bill's got nothing on a car horn.
Look them in the eye. You have to look them in the eyes like, you see me, I see you, I'm doing this.
That's ahead. It's the show.
And speaking of car horns, which we kind of, sort of were.
Kind of.
To the Valley Freeways, accidents on the 51 southbound at McDowell. No reports of any heavy slowing around that yet. Also a collision, I-10 eastbound at 35th Avenue. And there is some heavy slowing on the 202 westbound as you approach 24th Street. It'll stay partly cloudy tonight around the valley. We also have a 30% chance for some rain. Overnight lows will be around 60. Partly cloudy again, a slight chance for showers tomorrow with a high of 80. Currently, relative humidity is at 16%. It's partly cloudy and 80 degrees at 236.
KJZZ is supported by the Maricopa County Home and Landscape Show this Friday through Sunday at the State Fairgrounds. Exhibits and seminars plus featured guest Jonathan and Drew Scott from HGTV series The Property Brothers. Info at mchomeshows.com.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. Saudi Arabia says it's ended its bombing campaign against Houthi rebels in Yemen. The Saudi Defense Ministry said the focus would now shift towards finding a political solution and preventing the movement of the Houthi fighters. But it said military force would still be used when needed and operations might continue on a reduced scale. Iran, which backs the rebels, described the Saudi announcement as a step forward. The army in South Africa has begun deploying in areas hit by a wave of violence against immigrants from elsewhere in Africa. Soldiers are patrolling parts of the provinces of KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng, including the volatile township of Alexandra in Johannesburg, where a Mozambican man was killed. Poland has announced a major deal to buy Patriot surface-to-air missiles from the United States. Warsaw has accelerated its military modernization program following Russia's annexation of Crimea and its support for separatists in eastern Ukraine. The British authorities have arrested a financial trader, Navinder Singh Sarau, on fraud charges at the request of the United States. The US Justice Department wants him extradited over allegations he manipulated US stock markets, including one event in May 2010 known as the flash crash, when the main index fell 600 points in 5 minutes. Italian investigators have questioned the captain of a ship that capsized in the Mediterranean on Sunday, causing the deaths of about 800 migrants. The captain, a Tunisian named as Mohamed Ali Malik, will appear in court in Sicily on Friday, charged with mass murder. The U.S. Justice Department has opened a federal investigation into the death of an African-American man who suffered spinal injuries as he was arrested. The probe will try to find out if 27-year-old Freddie Gray's civil rights had been violated when he was detained in Baltimore 9 days ago. BBC News.
The city of Phoenix is preparing to sell the Sheraton Hotel downtown. The hotel has lost $38 million since 2008, and the city is now refinancing that debt. The city got involved with the hotel as a companion of sorts to the refurbishing of the Phoenix Convention Center. Last week on the show, we talked to Deputy City Manager Paul Blue about why Phoenix was moving out of the hotel business. Now we turn to Tulane Economics Professor James Alm, who understands the rationale of government entities trying to drive economic growth, but says it rarely works out.
There are possibilities of these kinds of, spillover types of effects where there's a virtuous cycle in some sense. The government spends something, there's a surge in economic activity that attracts new businesses, restaurants, hotels, things like that. It revitalizes a downtown area that otherwise had been languishing. And the overall effect is that these at least the hope, is that this investment will pay off for it, itself. Are there examples where that's happened? Pause.
Right.
I think that to the extent that any of these types of investments ever make any sense, it's when, like a sports stadium or a hotel, it's when the investment is taking place in an otherwise underdeveloped and undeveloped area, in an urban core.
Should our expectations be greater in general as a municipality, as a state, whatever it may be, for private industry to be more willing to jump in on situations like this when we consider that if a private investment succeeds, the reward is going to greatly outweigh the risks? Or does it really come back to government policy needs to be better, the situations need to be better, and then private industry will jump in?
Well, which comes first? I think it's what you're kind of partly getting at. Does the government have to provide the basic environment in which private enterprises can flourish before the private enterprises will undertake that investment? That's a tougher question. I think what's partly going on here also, though, is that should it be government that's bearing the risk when the private sector is unwilling to make those investments? And especially at a time when, for the government to make those investments, to undertake the risk, this comes at the expense of other types of potentially beneficial public investments. And so what's being asked, in some sense, is that the government should make these investments, that they should bear the risk. If they pan out, then we, the private sector, will start making our investments. And only then will we start making these investments. I think that's putting far more of the risk on the public sector than should be the case.
So what is the case for public sector intervention?
When private markets aren't working very well. So when there are activities like what economists refer to as the public good, like a national defense or police protection or crime protection or things like that, where the private individuals are not going to provide those in amounts that people really value. I don't really see the case, and most economists don't, virtually no economists do. Economic development officials are a different category here, but most economists don't see the case for market failure to be all that strong in the types of instances that are being called for building a hotel or building a sports stadium. Why shouldn't it be, if there really is going to be a return for these types of investments to the sports owners or to the hotel owners, they should undertake those. They're going to get the return. They're going to get the big rewards from it.
James Alm is professor and chair of economics at Tulane University. Professor, thank you for the time.
My pleasure.
Arizona has been struggling with a shortage of medical professionals for a number of years, and the problem is even starker in rural areas. Efforts are underway to turn the tide. One of those is led by Dr. Carlos Gonzalez of the Rural Health Professions Program at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Dr. Gonzalez is a self-described urban kid who grew to enjoy practicing in rural areas. He says it's important to get medical students exposed to those cities and towns.
Where I send medical students from their first year to their fourth years, into various parts of Arizona, both along the border in Douglas and Bisbee and Yuma, up on the reservation in Navajo and Hopi and White River, Apache land, and then in the agriculture midsection, that would be Safford, Globe, Payson.
When they're exposed to that, are they telling you that, in part, like you said, they just didn't know about it and now they might want to give it a shot, or are they still thinking, well, that was quaint, but I still like the big city?
Well, I can't lie. We don't get 100% of the kids to go into rural areas, but we get a significant portion of those kids that are experienced. If they go into primary care, family medicine, pediatrics, or internal medicine, they often do go into rural areas. However, if they go into surgery or one of the subspecialties, at least what they have now is sensitivity to the issues in rural Arizona, and so they're more apt to help their colleagues who are out there in the rural aspects. We have successes because a lot of the preceptors that I'm using now, those are the individuals that are teaching our medical students, were in RHPP 10, 15 years ago. It does work, and I'm having now the second generation, if you will, that are willing to teach the students.
Are there other ways that you've heard about that could counter the shortage? Because this is becoming, it's been a concern, but it's becoming an even greater concern now.
Unfortunately, most of the rural docs are my age or a little bit older, and we're about ready to retire, all of us. We're in the late 50s to early 60s range. There is an estimated need of approximately 200 or so new physicians that need to come out to replace all of us that have been out here for a while. One of the ways that we can do that is what both the federal government and the Arizona state government have done, which is through the loan repayment, encouraging individuals to go into these rural areas and have their medical student loans paid off with service. They get so much per year of their total loan written off because they're providing this service to Arizona's needy.
You sound really optimistic. How much of that comes from your own experience?
I went to Gallup. I went to Ganado. And I went down to Nogales. And that sort of piqued my interest. And so when I was ready to do something different, I actually went into Patagonia, where I was the only doctor for 1,600 square miles. Mm-hmm. And really being a rural doc, and I found that so enjoyable, and it was so self-educating. I learned how to be a better doctor, basically, because of being in that rural setting.
Dr. Carlos Gonzalez of the Rural Health Professions Program at the U of A in Tucson.
Lots of produce crosses into Arizona from Mexico, and a food bank in Nogales is working to get those fruits and veggies onto plates rather than having it go into landfills. Borderlands Food Bank has been rescuing that produce for 2 decades. Sellers call and the food bank's drivers can pick the produce up. Workers then figure out what's good and what isn't. Yolanda Soto is Borderland Food Bank's president and CEO.
Well, there's many variables about regarding why it is donated to us. It could be because the product is too large, too small, there's no market, or the market's too high. It rained and the product was spotted. There's some scarring on the product or maybe some little black dots. So there's a variety of reasons of why it's donated.
I would imagine that you have to make your determinations and do your work pretty quickly. We're not talking non-perishable foods here. Even produce that's good when it gets to you probably won't stay good for all that long, right?
Absolutely. It loses its lifespan 10 to 15% per day. And so that's when the determination is made. Where are we going to use it? How good is it? Will it last? If it's donated on Monday, will it be good for Saturday for our powwow program? Or is it so good, 100% or 90% that we can offer it out to another state, and it's going to be okay for travel time and then warehousing and then distribution at that warehouse.
When you're looking through the produce, how do you make the determination that, yes, maybe aesthetically this isn't beautiful, but it's still perfectly safe to eat and perfectly healthy to eat?
Yeah, all the product health-wise is in perfectly good condition. As far as quality-wise, we make the determination at the warehouse when it's donated to us. Most of the time, we don't even have to, because for the 20 years that we have been doing this, we've been educating the produce industry, don't offer me anything less than 75% or better, because I'm not going to take it.
Do you have a sense of how much produce you distribute on a weekly or monthly basis?
Well, I could tell you that. Last year, we distributed 38 million pounds of produce. The majority of that stays within the state of Arizona, Santa Cruz County, and, of course, the rest of the state. About 17 to 18% of it goes out of state. And a very small percentage, maybe 7 or 8%, goes into Mexico through our international program.
It seems kind of surprising to me that, given where you're located in the state with all the agriculture going on around you, that so many people have trouble getting fresh produce.
Fresh produce is very expensive. And so the families that come to us are usually the families who cannot afford the vegetables. And of course, as we all know, vegetables are a very nutritious product, but it is an expensive commodity. The good thing about receiving it from us is that it's a win-win situation for grocery stores. The people who can't afford it are developing a taste for it. And eventually those children who develop the taste will grow up and hopefully can afford it, will continue to eat it. Or the families who at the moment can't afford it will definitely also continue to be able to purchase it at the grocery store someday.
Are you concerned at all that grocery stores might sort of change their marketing and start accepting some of the produce that right now they're saying no thanks to and that comes to you?
No, I really don't think so, because I think that they are constricted by quality control. If you're going to go into a grocery store to purchase your product, I think you expect to purchase excellent product. Although our product is excellent, but it may be that it's got some scarring and people at the grocery store don't want to purchase that type of product. They want it to be perfect.
Well, that's my question then, I guess. It seems like what you're dealing with is still good produce, just
absolutely.
It just doesn't look as good.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, the consumer likes looks, don't we? It is unfortunate, but really, that's what we go after.
Yolanda Soto is president and CEO of Borderlands Food Banks in Nogales, Arizona. Yolanda, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Cloudy skies in the valley forecast for tonight and a 30% chance for some rain. Expect overnight lows to be around 60. And then for tomorrow, the chance for rain dips to 20%, looking for a high temperature around 80. Currently with relative humidity at 16%, well, partly cloudy at 80 degrees. Meanwhile, in valley traffic, an accident on the 51 southbound at McDowell.
KJZZ is supported by Peoria Subaru, offering a selection of new AWD vehicles, including the 2015 Subaru Forester, Outback Legacy, and more. Locally owned and operated for 25 years by the Moore family. Online at PeoriaSubaru.com.
Downtown Phoenix will be getting two new music venues next month. The co-owner of the Crescent Ballroom will be opening a new spot called Valley Bar, and the venue formerly known as the Mason Jar will reopen as the Rebel Lounge. So we thought it'd be a good time to check in on the Valley music scene. To do that, we welcome Benjamin Leatherman, clubs editor for Phoenix New Times.
The last couple of years, there's definitely been a resurgence of live music venues in the downtown Phoenix area. Most prominently with Crescent Ballroom, of course, which opened in 2011. But there's also been the Nash, which opened in 2012. That's become a haven for jazz. Last Exit Live, south of downtown, has been a great venue. And increasing amounts of concerts and other things. There's even some more other venues in the works, I hear, besides Valley Bar and Rebel Lounge.
Is that migrating from Tempe, which has sort of traditionally been sort of the where the Valley music scene emanates from? Is it? Are you seeing it moving from Tempe to downtown Phoenix?
Yes, but it's over the last decade or so, there's kind of it's ebbed and flowed between Tempe and Phoenix. I mean, 10 years ago, it seemed like some of the biggest epicenters in live music were in downtown Phoenix. Or there were a lot of great venues operating in downtown Phoenix, like Modified Arts was kind of like the indie rock haven. And there was also like the Paper Heart Gallery and other spots along Grand Avenue and along Roosevelt Row that, you know, were getting a lot of good shows and a lot of the focus. And then in 2009, around that era, things kind of shifted more back towards Tempe. I mean, one of my colleagues famously and rather erroneously stated, downtown is OVA. After the Modified closed.
Said it like that, right?
Yeah, OVAH, downtown is OVA. After, you know, Modified, which, like I said, was an epicenter, closed. And around that time, like the Sail Inn in Tempe had kind of opened up. And a little later after that, kind of a redux of Long Wong's had opened. And so the focus shifted. But then again in 2010, 2011, it started going back towards Phoenix again, like with the opening of the Crescent Ballroom. So it's always just been gone back and forth.
So do you think it will continue to go back and forth, or do you think it's going to stay in downtown Phoenix at least for a while now?
Who can say? I mean, there's a lot of energy happening in downtown Phoenix's music scene, but Tempe has kind of had its music community has kind of suffered the loss of a lot of great venues, such as the Sail Inn, Long Wong's, but it's by no means dead because there's still great shows being offered, like at Yucca Tap Room and Casa Lounge, and even a very, very strong house party scene.
Do you see different types of shows in those two cities?
It is true that a lot of more nationally known artists are playing downtown venues, but they're still like the marquee. So I'd have to go no, because you do see a lot. Both cities offer a variety of different types of genres and acts.
Benjamin Leatherman is Clubs Editor for Phoenix New Times. Benjamin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Hungarian movie White God centers around a girl named Lily and her dog Hagen. After the city imposes a fee on mixed-breed dogs, Lily's father sets Hagen loose on the streets, and he becomes the unlikely leader of a coup against humans. Hagen is played by two dogs that came from a trailer park in a small border town in Arizona. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry has more.
Imagine swarms of hundreds of angry dogs tearing through desolate streets, rioting, looting, ripping into purses as if they're on a mission. That's what you see in White God, and leading the pack is Hagen, a muscular-looking mahogany-colored dog, part lab, part Shar-Pei, with intense, almost sad-looking eyes. Hagen is played by Arizona dogs Luke and Bodie. They now live in Acton, California with their owner and trainer, Teresa Ann Miller.
At the time, the director was casting. He was looking for a dog that would stand out, and that's what Luke and Bodie are. They're just that one in a million face, but better than that, they're two in a million because they have a photo double.
But Miller has another unique challenge, getting a dog to act.
It's not that Hagen has a lot of tricks that he does, but you can really appreciate and see the acting that he portrays. To have a dog who can't talk his lines, who can't speak his part, convey the emotion of the particular scene and what the dog's going through at the time.
What's even more amazing is that it's not just Hagen on screen, but there are hundreds of other dogs following him in droves, and none of them are computer generated.
That's 250 dogs running together through the streets of Budapest.
Miller says that most of these new canine actors were shelter dogs, and that after filming, nearly all of them were adopted. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News.
White God begins showing tomorrow at Film Bar in Phoenix.
More than 200 people showed up this morning for the 10th annual Maricopa County and City of Phoenix Bike to Work Day. It's a group bike ride from Park Central in Midtown to City Hall. But if you think biking to work is just a recipe for sweaty work clothes and a strained hamstring, the show's Annika Klein has some advice.
This sound might not be enough to protect cyclists on the road. But on Bike to Work Day, you're surrounded by police officers on motorcycles, not to mention more than 100 other bikers. And that makes new riders like Kimberly Claw feel safer.
I'm nervous if I'm biking alone, but if I bike with a group, I'm more comfortable.
It's tough to say if new riders out here today will opt for the bike tomorrow. So I asked some of the spandex-clad, seasoned riders for tips on how to bike to work. First, make sure drivers actually see you.
Look them in the eye. You have to look them in the eyes like, you see me, I see you, I'm doing this.
That's Eartha Washington, who commutes to work 18 miles one way. If that seems like a lot, here's another tip from Marion Corvo, who commutes 33 miles.
It's hard to do round trip, but I'll do one way.
How does she get back home?
On the bus.
Libby Coyner is a member of Phoenix Spokespeople, a nonprofit working to make Phoenix more bike-friendly. She says you can have your normal morning routine and bike, too. You can even grab that coffee to go.
Oh, definitely. A lot of us have coffee holders on our bikes.
So, you've planned your commute, you've got your coffee, you've made eye contact. The last thing you need to do is to get to work looking more or less like you did when you walked out the door. Colin Veach says looking fresh after a bike ride can be tough.
Yeah, definitely. I always arrive a little bit early, try to get there early in the morning before it gets really hot, and I bring a change of clothes.
After the helmets are strapped on tight, it's time to go to work. The bikes flood into Central Avenue, taking up the street and stopping traffic. But tomorrow, it's back to sharing the road. And maybe there will be a few more bikes on it than before. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
Be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. A big award for a Northern Arizona museum, and we'll check in on how the new AZ Merit Test is rolling out in schools. That and much more tomorrow at 2 on the show.
Today's show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs of the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. The executive producer is John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know some good story ideas. Let us know what you like, what you don't like about the show. You can email us at theshow@kjzz.org. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Hotel Del Coronado. Connecting happens the moment you choose to disconnect. With white sand beaches, San Diego weather, and personalized service and experiences. Reservations at hoteldel.com. Connect today.